Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Welcome to Interchange. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. Joining me by phone from Washington, D.C. is Rich Williams from the Indiana Public Interest Research Group. Rich, thanks for calling in today.
Yeah, thanks so much. Hey there, Allison.
This evening, we will be talking about the student debt discussion that is happening in Congress currently and the problems and solutions that go along with that. Rich, can you begin by talking about the Indiana Public Interest Research Group and how it is involved in the student loan discussion?
Yeah, definitely. So again, my name is Rich Williams. I'm the Federal Higher Education Advocate for the Indiana Public Interest Research Group, or Indiana PIRG, based out of Washington, D.C. So Indiana PIRG is an independent statewide student organization that works on issues like environmental protection, consumer protection, hunger and homelessness, and college affordability. So for nearly 35 years, students on campus and around the state have been making a big difference in people's lives on winning concrete results that help make the community a better place. You know, for example, students at the Indiana University chapter have registered thousands of students to vote, raised more than $20,000 for hunger and homelessness relief, and trained more than 200 interns to work on important issues and engage civically in their community.
So I want to discuss the act that is being discussed right now in the Senate, and it's kind of a funny name. It sounds like it's going against what it's for, but the Stop the Student Loan Rate Hike Act. And the thing that I think is funny about that is, depending on where you think that stop applies, you could really be on either side of the aisle there. But the idea being that come July, the rate for federally backed student loans would jump from 3.2 to 6.4, would double. And there's been bipartisan support for keeping the rate low. However, that hasn't passed through. Can you give me kind of a summary of what's been going on this spring as that discussion happens in Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you hit it right on the head. You know, if Congress does not act by July 1st, around 7.5 million students around the country will see their interest rates double. And that would have a pretty big impact here in Indiana. So just students in our state would see about $270 million of extra student debt just for each year Congress does not take action on this issue. I think people can recognize that higher education is practically a necessity these days. And the social and economic health of, our state relies on the success of its students and workers. But the recession has left the state with less money to spend on higher education and other services, really squeezing families who are already straining to pay for college for their children, as well as unemployed folks who are seeking new skills to stay competitive in the job market. So students and families are turning to federal student loans to help finance their degrees or credentials. And now 62% of Indiana's graduates carry student loan debt, with an average student graduating with over $27,000 of debt. So kind of where how we came to this is a couple years back in 2007, Congress came together and passed the College Cost Reduction and Access Act. Among other college affordability things it did, it helped reduce the interest rates on subsidized Stafford loans. These are loans that the most needy students get, where the government will help pick up the interest while the student's in school, so interest doesn't actually accumulate until the borrower graduates. Helped reduce that student loan interest rate from 6.8% back in 2007 to 3.4% where it is now. Now, when Congress passed it, 5 years ago, it was planned to be a four-year decrease, but no one really imagined we'd be in the economic situation that we are right now. And so the question comes up with so many other pieces of legislation that are routinely renewed or extended. And I think most people would agree, in this economy with rising college costs, struggling family finances, and an uncertain job market for graduates, the last thing we should be doing is letting interest rates double on student loans. So that kind of leads us to the situation we're up to right now, where both members of Congress, both parties in Congress, recognize the importance of this issue and helping stem ever-growing debt for students here in the state and across the country. So a couple weeks ago, the House of Representatives introduced a bill to prevent interest rates from doubling and passed it. Unfortunately, they did it and they acted so quickly, it wasn't a very bipartisan fashion. So the White House has rejected the bill and has threatened to veto it because they're paying for keeping interest rates low by cutting funding for preventative health care measures to help important things like preventing obesity and promoting healthy living. There are two bills introduced in the Senate. The Republicans in the Senate have introduced the same bill as the House, but we know that's not going to go anywhere. And the Democrats have introduced a bill, which is also paid for, by the way, that the opposite party is not enthusiastic about. Both bills came up for a vote a couple weeks ago and didn't achieve enough votes to move conversation forward. So the Senate is currently back at the drawing board trying to identify new ways to keep interest rates low without actually increasing the national deficit by doing it. We're confident that both sides will be able to come together since everyone is already agreeing on a policy. They just need to figure out some of the details of the bill now going forward.
All right. That's a great summary. And what is clear is that the issue is how are we going to pay for this? Not that it should happen. And can I clarify then what it means to pay for this? So you would think that if you just keep doing what you're doing, you're actually not incurring any extra cost. It's 3.2 now. And if it stays that, then what's the big deal? But I guess, can you talk about the tactics for subsidizing loans? It's not actually, so is the government buying loans from somewhere else and paying some of the interest and only passing part of the interest on to the student that it gives it to?
Yeah, so it's kind of a funny thing that Congress does. You know, just like any family, they have various budgeting strategies to just keep track of spending and revenues. And currently, because the legislation is set to expire, Congress has budgeted for the increase in student loans, so additional revenues coming into the Treasury. So if you were to keep interest rates low, that would, in fact, not deliver on the revenues that Congress is currently counting on. So on paper, it would seem like it would be increasing the deficit. Now, with student loans, it's a little trickier than that because this is not direct spending. You know, we cut checks all the time. That is a payout to companies for subsidies. But this is a student loan. So the taxpayers are coming together to provide a loan to a student so they can go to school, and we'll collect that money back as the student repays their loan with interest. So it's not like the government has been losing money at all on this arrangement. They're just needing to try to find a way to make up in the projected lost revenues. So if this is really the case, we think, you know, Congress can, there's a lot of other ideas that Congress can tap into to make up those revenues. Certainly they shouldn't continue to look for students to pay those revenues with student debt already being so high.
And can you explain why July is the deadline on this discussion?
Yeah, you know, it kind of makes you think because it's an interesting time. It's basically just when the legislation is set to expire. There's no convenient other reason, except it's this deadline has been proposing problems for students. I mean, luckily, it's between academic years, So folks, you know, high school seniors looking to go to school next year, or students who are currently in college looking to start their next academic year, luckily don't have to deal with interest rates doubling halfway through the year. But July 1st is a really inconvenient time for a lot of families, because right now they're sitting around the dinner table trying to figure out how to pay for school next year. Financial aid award letters went out for most schools up to a month ago. And so there's this indecision in Congress, and it's really at the consequence of families trying to plan how they're going to pay for school next year. So while Congress really does have until July 1st, and there's time for them to figure this out, you know, time is really ticking for families as they try to plan their budgets for paying for school next year.
And is this the kind of thing that the moment it expires on July 1st, if you try and take out a loan the next day to begin school, say in September, that rate is high immediately, or is there a kind of phase out period?
No, there's no phase out period. The second July 1st hits, any new loans that are taken out by students will have double the interest rate from what they're currently borrowing. So the good news is for, you know, students who already have loans, those loans are locked in at the interest rate they currently have. So this only affects new loans. But, you know, across the country, that's 7.5 million students who are going to be borrowing new loans next year. And a pretty big impact, about $1,000 of student loan debt for each year that Congress doesn't act.
And if they don't act, so they don't come to a decision by July 1st and those rates spike, is this something that can become a discussion again once the General Assembly reconvenes in the fall?
It's tough to say. You know, student loan interest rates are one piece of many pieces in a big puzzle on college affordability. And so if they fail to reach agreement on this issue, there are potentially other things they can do to offset that extra $1,000 of debt. But it is unlikely that Congress would be able to circle back around and solve this issue if the July 1st issue deadline comes up and passes. The reason being, just as students are taking out loans and signing their master promissory note, which is basically the contract for their loan, those are really hard to go back and start changing once they're made. So I suspect July 1st really is the hard and fast deadline for this.
It is interesting because there is, everyone wants to keep the interest rate down. So there is clearly on all sides a value of our higher education and allowing anyone who works to get there to go to college. I was hoping you could discuss a little bit too about why higher education is important and what it's bringing to this country.
Oh, certainly. Well, you know, I think everyone can agree that higher education is certainly a necessity, but you know, people recognize it's getting harder and harder to afford. We're seeing massive state cuts just around the country to higher education. And you know, how tuition is set at least public schools is every dollar that the state cuts is another dollar that has to be made up in tuition revenue for the schools. So as states are cutting, it's causing tuition to go up. And that increase is forcing students and families to borrow more. Now, even with the higher levels of debt that students are graduating with, you know, a college degree or college credentials at any level are certainly worth the investment just because of the individual and society benefits that they come with. So individually, we know that, you know, if you go to college, you'll be making more over the course of your lifetime. Some people project hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million more over your lifetime. You'll be trained more in critical thinking skills that allow you to succeed in different workplaces. You'll have more choice of where you want to work and the things that you're able to do. And then it's important for the state and the federal government to invest in higher education, too, because as people are making more money, they're paying more in taxes at the local, state, and federal level, which offsets that that cost and is actually an investment. We rely on our higher education to train our next generation of doctors and entrepreneurs and nurses, the folks who are going to solve all of our current problems in society years from now. And college graduates are more engaged in their community, so more likely to vote, more likely to volunteer, and create an environment of robust communities. So it's absolutely worth investing in, both individually and absolutely worth investing in at the state and federal level. We've just hit this current economic slide where budgets are tight and folks have to make some tough decisions. But, you know, we would argue that higher education is worth the investment, and not all spending is equal. So we are asking, certainly our senators here in the state, Senator Lugar and Coates, to support legislation to prevent interest rates from doubling, and also support maintaining, if not increasing, many of the important higher education investment and student aid programs that are out there helping students go to school.
All right. Thanks, Rich. We are speaking with Rich Williams, a higher education advocate with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group in Washington, D.C., and we'll be back in just a moment to get a little deeper into the complicated puzzle of student loans.
Support for WFHB comes from Bloom Magazine, a proud underwriter of community radio. Bloom Magazine and United Way present the Front Page Challenge for businesses and organizations of all sizes. To learn how you can raise money for United Way and be on the cover of Bloom Magazine, you can visit magbloom.com. That's magbloom.com.
We're back on Interchange. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. My guest today is Rich Williams, a higher education advocate from the U.S. Public Interest Research Group for Indiana. He's speaking to us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Rich, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You actually mentioned a number for specifically in Indiana that those students who are graduating with debt, and it's over two-thirds of students here in Indiana, have $27,000 average to pay back, and that's higher than the national average of $25,000. Can you talk a little bit more about some of these numbers here that we're facing in Indiana?
Yeah, so, you know, student debt across the country varies, a lot of it because of higher education funding at the state level. We're seeing as states pull back more funding, tuition just goes up higher, and so some states vary a little bit. The national average is now two-thirds of college graduates need to borrow a loan, and their average student loan debt is $25,000. But here in Indiana, about 62% of graduates now carry student loan debt with an average of $27,000 per borrower.
Do you have any insight as to why college tuition is going up so fast and so much over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so the biggest factor is just the local and state economies and how states are able to invest in local higher education institutions. So, you know, higher education is still very a state-based thing. And different states have been able to prioritize it in different ways, but the similar thread across all states is there's just been massive shortfalls and massive hits to state revenue because of the economy. You know, everyone's hurting, down from families to the state budget. And because of that, we've seen over the past few years just massive state cuts. Over the past few years, over 40 of the 50 states in the country have cut higher education funding, sometimes by double digits. And when that funding is reduced, it causes tuition to go up. So in reality, the higher education institutions, your local colleges, are not taking in any extra money out of the tuition that's being paid. Tuition is going up merely because the state had to cut budgets. So a lot of people sometimes, get confused about, well, my tuition is going up by 10% this year. Really, from the school's perspective, funding is not going up, maybe by inflation, but the reason why its tuition is increasing so fast is because states have been cutting back at a more rapid rate. So that accounts for most of why tuition is going up. And then there's some smaller issues, but that's the big one. It's easy to just focus on tuition, though, but really it's a bigger problem of college costs in general. So it's easy to forget that there's many other components that go into paying for college, from room and board to even buying textbooks and transportation. So as gas prices increase and textbook costs increase to now $1,100 per student per year, which is a significant amount of money for community college students, all that also puts a lot of pressure and is causing students to borrow more in student loans.
But it seems like once you get kind of to the periphery of costs, things get a little shady. The textbook costs are rising really, really fast. Some kind of shady things with just the loans that you get, or some of the student debit card tactics and ways that the financial institutions that are backing student loans kind of skim some off the top. Can you talk about some of that periphery that's adding up the cost as well?
Certainly, and it's probably helpful to just think about, and that's why we like focusing on student debt as an issue, because it really encompasses not just tuition, the normal price that folks think about, but really encompasses all costs of college education and is a decent benchmark and barometer about how quickly things are rising. And let me tell you, things are rising fast. So just looking nationally, looking back just a little under 15 years ago, only about one-third of college graduates needed to take out a loan, and those who needed to borrow only needed to borrow about $12,000 on average. And now what we're seeing is two-thirds of graduates needing to borrow and their average debt burden being over $25,000, and like we discussed, even higher here in Indiana. And so it's not just a big number. That debt burden comes with some serious consequences. So we're seeing high levels of debt prevent important life decisions from graduates, whether it's buying a car or buying a home. We know in our local economies we need first-time home buyers to have confidence in the market again, but we're just seeing recent college graduates strapped down with so much loan debt that they're having to delay by several years buying a home for the first time. We're also seeing graduates with high levels of debt delaying other things we just view as the basic American dream, like getting married and starting a family. All those things are being delayed. And then that's not to say, once you can get married and start a family, if you can even save for your kids' retirement, your kids' college education, or your own personal retirement. But then there's the economy question, where college graduates with a lot of loan debt just can't go into certain careers, particularly careers that are socially valuable but historically low-paying, like being a teacher or doing social work. So this student loan debt burden has some serious consequences to it. So that's why we focus on student loan debt as kind of a barometer of what's happening. Now, looking at some of the other components that are driving up student debt, we have, starting from high school, college students or high school students are looking at college and questioning whether they can pay for it. And so, we know we need about 3 million more degree holders than we're currently on pace for in order to meet workforce demands. That's nationally. And certainly quite a few here in the state, too. But we are going to be short because students aren't qualified high school graduates are choosing not to go to college because of the costs that they'll incur. Likewise, once students are in school, They're working more hours to try to offset borrowing, and the more hours that they work while they're in school, sometimes being a full-time student and a full-time worker, they reduce their chances of graduating. And then once they add on the other side, all the consequences that high debt hits them with. So some of the other things we're looking at is textbook prices. Textbooks now are $1,100 per student per year. And I think folks can recognize when, they were in school or they have kids or sons who are in school, that $200 textbook was always just something you accepted because you knew you needed, but you never questioned why. It turned out that textbook prices are rising four times faster than inflation because publishers are engaged in aggressive tactics to help increase their profit margins at the expense of students. So we're seeing over the past few years, publishers taking advantage of, you could describe as a broken market that doesn't work on supply and demand, where the publishers have to just market to professors. The professors then select the textbook, and then the student is hamstrung and has to buy what's selected. So there's actually no supply and demand in this textbook market. And so publishers have been doing a couple things to help increase those prices, start coming out with new editions every 2 years. While that makes sense for certain sciences, like, if you're studying to be a nurse or in biology or things that change rapidly, it doesn't make sense for a whole bunch of other subjects like geometry, which hasn't changed in hundreds of years. So these are all tactics that help drive up the costs of textbooks so that the publishers can profit at the student's expense. Another issue we've just started working on and issued a report just the other week, the campus debit card trap. It looks how banks and other financial institutions are now signing contracts with almost 900 campuses around the country that allows them to skim millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in student aid money, preventing students from spending it on education costs and putting it into bank profits instead. So I think people would be outraged to know that banks have been now partnering with 900 schools that impact 9 million students, and it impacts the most needy students in the country. So we're focused on that as well. A couple other issues, private student loans. So as we talked about, federal student loans are the loans that most students borrow. But more and more students are looking at private student loans for paying for college. Now, private student loans are a very opaque market. One attorney general referred to them as the Wild West of lending because there's really not many consumer protections or safeguards for borrowers once you take out a private student loan, unlike federal student loans that are usually fixed interest rates and have good repayment options like income-based repayment, which caps the amount you pay each month on your student loan based on your salary, or public service loan forgiveness, which forgives your loan after 10 years of repayment if you do work in a public service career. Private student loans have none of that, and they're usually variable interest rates, sometimes as high as 20%. And so it's almost like paying for college on a credit card. And then once you take out a private student loan, unlike other forms of consumer debt, you can never get bankruptcy protection. So if you're a student who does everything right and goes to school but then falls on hard times, whether because you get sick or injured and can't work or for whatever reason, you can find no protection in bankruptcy. And that's true with federal loans, too. So it's a problem that needs addressing.
That's astounding, the numbers that you've listed there. One thing I want to go back to really quick about these debit cards that you mentioned. So they're kind of preying on the poorest people. Students are not thought of as big cash cows there. Is this a tactic that also gets applied to the incredibly wealthy, or is this specifically a target of students?
It looks like, from our research, it's a little bit of both. There's two different types of players happening in this market. First is the traditional banks, and that's like your Wells Fargo and your U.S. Bank, Huntington Bank. So traditional banks have a long history of targeting colleges as gatekeepers to gain access to young consumers. Young people, 18 to 20, many times have personal accounts, but when they make the move to college, many of them are going to get a checking account or start using a bank closer to the college or start using one for the first time as they develop that financial literacy and financial independence. So banks for a long time have targeted schools to try to gain access to bulk amounts of consumers and get more bang for their buck. They know a student using their banking products is much more likely, once they graduate, to then take out a car loan or take out a home loan from their bank, too. So banks are forking over big bucks. You know, looking over at Ohio, Huntington Bank just paid $25 million to the school with an additional $100 million of local lending to areas around the school just to sign an exclusive partnership with the school.
Wow.
What they do, and what many of these banks do, is they physically attach banking products to student IDs. So your student ID now acts as a debit card. And while this could provide some convenience to students, because it's an exclusive contract that's signed, it really provides no options for the student consumer. A student coming into school without a bank account and is looking for one is much more likely to see that the bank account that's now co-branded and attached to their student ID, see that as an implicit endorsement by the school for that product. And so they're more likely to take that to take the bank up on using their product. And that's exactly what the bank hopes for. In reality, that's not an implicit endorsement at all. And the agreement is usually based on who gives the student the most, or who gives the college the most money. The second type of player that we see in this market is new financial firms, which are somewhat like tech companies that are not banks themselves, but partner with banks to offer bank services. And this is the bulk of the market out there. About 750 schools now have partnerships with these financial firms. And what they do is they they allow schools to totally privatize their financial aid disbursement process and help streamline the disbursement of federal student aid, which helps the college reduce administrative costs. But then those costs are then shifted to students in the form of fee-laden debit cards. So these entities, financial firms, exist almost exclusively to capture federal student aid. About $160 billion in federal student aid was released and disbursed to students this year alone to some of the most needy students in the country. So these financial firms make their money off capturing the federal student aid, making money off the deposits, and then charging students fees for using it. So these fees are, certainly to some of the most low-income, needy students who should really be spending every dollar of that federal student aid on educational expenses, not in education and high bank fees.
I want to segue then into the idea of for-profit higher education, which you can get federal funding for, though it's not in the same category as your public institutions that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Problems with for-profit colleges have started rising over the past few years. And for folks who don't know what a for-profit college is, a couple examples are the University of Phoenix, ITT Tech, Corinthian College, Everest, and several others. These schools are often, they're for-profit companies. So unlike your community college and even your private not-for-profit school that doesn't make profits, these schools seek to make revenues and profits. And they're big companies, and they're likely traded openly on the stock market and Wall Street. So they have a set of pressures and a set of bottom lines that other schools in the community don't share. For example, a community college can focus on how can we provide the best educational content for our students, where sometimes in this economy, with the pressure being what it is on businesses to deliver revenues, these colleges, their bottom line could very well be how much money are we making for our investors? And of course, they make money off of charging students higher costs. So what we're seeing now is for-profit colleges like University of Phoenix, all of them collectively educating about 13% of students nationally, but they soak up 25% of all federal student aid and are responsible for one out of every two students who defaults in the federal student loan
program. Wow.
So let me just say, it's such a profound stat.
Is it that people who enroll in for-profit schools, is that a lower income on average student anyway?
Traditionally, from what we've seen, yes, many of the students who go to for-profit colleges are lower income. Well, one main reason, and that's because they're eligible for more federal student aid money. So it would seem that these for-profit colleges have created business models that allow them to capitalize off federal student aid. And a big component of that is recruiting the students who are most eligible. And while if students were graduating from these institutions and becoming really successful and being able to pay their loans, I don't know if anyone would have a problem. But the truth is, students graduating from these schools are in heavy debt and defaulting at incredibly rapid rates, which indicates that either they're being charged way too much to be able to afford their salaries once they're coming out, and that's why they're defaulting, or the educational content that they're learning is not quality enough to provide them high salaries to pay their loans off, or a mixture of both. It gets even more devious as some of these schools have devised other recruiting methods that target other kind of vulnerable sections of our society, like veterans. There's a rule called the 90-10 rule, which is a consumer protection that says no school can get more than 90% of their revenues from federal student aid sources. They have to find 10% of their money from private, students going to their school. And that's a consumer protection because if no one's willing to pay at least 10%, then you probably don't have a good product. except there's a loophole in that rule that allows other government source funding, like money from the GI Bill or workforce investment money, to be used on that 10% side. So there's been several stories in the New York Times, particularly by Holly Petraeus, the wife of another famous military Petraeus, calling out the industry for viewing veterans as dollar signs in uniform, because for every one veteran that they recruit, they can recruit 9 other students on full federal aid. So the industry has gotten quite a bit of scrutiny for that as well.
And that brings up a type of student that isn't even considered as much during the student loan debt. I mean, we know it's hard enough for someone who has graduated with their degree. They're coming away with all this debt, and that stymies them getting a house or going for their dream job, things like that. But what about the student who doesn't even graduate, and then they have that debt?
Well, it's a huge problem. So if you try to go to school and for whatever reason it doesn't work out, a lot of times it's, maybe there's a death in the family and you have to go and take care of your family, or maybe there's a sickness in the family, or maybe just college didn't work out for you. The only way that you get a higher earning potential is by actually finishing a credential, whether it's a year, 2 years, or a 4-year program. And so folks who are dropping out are spending the money but getting none of the benefits. And so what we're starting to see is a rising level of students who try to go to school and then can't, for whatever reason, complete. And that's starting to weigh them down. So certainly, Congress and states should look at doing more to provide at least preferable repayment terms that allow them support for paying off their student loan debt, whether it's taking a longer period of time or helping to subsidize it so that they can repay those debt obligations. you know, a couple other cross sections of folks out there that were concerned about not only are students taking out more in loan debt, but parents are as well. We're seeing more and more parents taking out student loans for their kids to help, you know, in part offset some of the burdens that students are taking out on. But then it leaves the parents in with student loan debt, which could be coupled with the student loan debt that they're already paying off. And it's coming at a time when probably they're getting close to thinking about retirement. So all of that takes a big toll. There's also a new study that just came out looking at older Americans that still have loan debt. You know, folks above the age of 55 still have almost $40 billion of student loan debt in their name. And so grandparents, either whether they took it out and for their grandkids, you know, signing for the loan, thinking that everything would be great, and then realizing that they're on the hook too, or older Americans who still haven't paid off all their loan debt. So this is really a cross-generational issue. It does not affect just the traditional 18 to 22-year-olds that most people think about.
All right, we're going to take a break. We are speaking with Rich Williams, the higher education advocate for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. He's on the phone from Washington, D.C. We're going to take a break and be right back on Interchange. Welcome back to Interchange. I'm your host, Allison Bektesh. On the phone with me today from Washington, D.C. is Rich Williams, a higher education advocate from the Public Interest Research Group for Indiana. We're talking about student loans, or student debt, rather, and the impending July 1st deadline of that rate hike, bringing student loans from 3.2% to 6.4%. So we've talked a lot about how hard it is for students. Let's talk about some solutions. Right now, we have this act that the Senate is discussing, and it's a little partisan. We know that we want the student loan rate to remain low. Can you talk again about the two solutions, I guess, that have been proposed by the Democrats and the Republicans?
So the good news is that both sides of the aisle already agree on the policy, and that's student loan interest rates should not double for 7.5 million students next year. The problem is, how do we work out the details to just get it through? So the Senate has, had two bills that were being considered. One bill by Senate Democrats that would prevent interest rates from doubling, and pay for that by closing a few corporate tax loopholes, or one particular that would allow wealthier individuals to avoid paying Social Security taxes. The Senate Republicans had a bill that would pay for it by cutting preventative funding from health care programs. Both bills came up for a vote the other week and did not secure enough votes to move forward for discussion. So the Senate's back at the drawing board to consider other options, which they're doing right now as we speak. The House of Representatives has already voted on a bill, which we know is not going to go anywhere either, but they recently issued a letter to President Obama with a couple other suggestions about how to offset the costs of finishing this bill. And so that has added to the dialogue over the past few days. And hopefully members of Congress can agree on one thing or another and come together and really finish this.
Not to be cynical, but the Congress does take a recess on July 1st. We don't have a bill that's in either branch that's even being discussed yet. Once it passes either the Senate or the House of Representatives, doesn't it also have to go to the other branch, get approved, and go to the president to get approved and all this before July 1st?
Yep, that's right. So we're expecting a down-to-the-wire vote on this bill. We're still confident that both sides, you know, will come together on the final details of the bill. And the good thing is, once Congress, if both sides of the aisle can agree on a set of ways to get this bill finalized, it could actually move pretty quickly through both sides of Congress. The reason why legislation slows down or gets jammed up is when there's disagreements. But if leadership of both parties agree on a final bill, they can actually get it through quite quickly. And we know President Obama's waiting to sign something. So if they can get their act together, which we think they will, towards the last week of June, which they still have time, we suspect that they'll be able to get it done quickly.
Okay, and so who is actually back at the drafting board in the Senate? Is that a bipartisan group?
We think there's ideas being picked around or kicked around. The tough thing is, over the past few years, or past year and a half especially, in this Congress, there's been some pretty big cuts to government spending. So they've been able to weed out what people would consider most of the low-hanging fruit. The problem with finding other programs that you could cut or reduce to pay for other programs is that they're there for a reason and someone supports them. So both parties have to figure out, which members of Congress support various options, and then would that work for the other side? So it's actually a complex negotiation process that's happening right now, but they should be able to find something here in the next few weeks.
And you're saying that it's complex because we can either take money from government-backed health measures or money from government-backed tax cuts for the wealthy?
Well, that was the original proposal. Those bills are not going to go anywhere. They already came up for a vote and didn't get enough votes to proceed. So they're actually going to just find new ways to pay for this bill now, and we don't know what those will be. But, yeah, it comes down to an issue of will Congress support students or not? And so you can combine any other combination with that. Democrats continue to point out that we're spending billions of dollars each year writing a check to oil companies. So their argument has been, are we going to support students and prevent loan debt from increasing, or are we going to keep cutting checks to oil companies? Likewise, Republicans have a whole set of other pay-fors that they could make similar arguments for. So I think it's just a process that takes a while, as with anything with Congress, but they'll get there.
Okay. My impression, just from watching, I guess, how the two sides are approaching this, is that it's being used, it's an election year, it's being used as such a partisan issue to the point that it seems almost ridiculous. If you are a Republican senator and you actually do support students and keeping that rate low, but you're standing with the Republicans who have decided not to vote for the Democrat bill because of where they're getting the funds. Let me rephrase this, because here in Indiana, we actually just set our Senator Lugar just lost the primaries and was kind of criticized for being bipartisan. And he lost to someone who has said they don't want to negotiate at all, who will be on the ticket this fall, Richard Murdoch. So I'm wondering how much you're seeing Senate really using this as a way to rally their own troops and make sure that back home they're being viewed as a staunch Republican instead of being viewed as someone who supports students. And isn't that costing them the entire student vote?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think each party has something in it in their interests. Republicans are supporting preventing interest rates from doubling, and they're looking at cutting a piece of health care, which to their base I think they think is something that is recruiting maybe for young Americans who are a little bit dubious of the president's health care system. And then the Democrats, likewise, wanting to prevent interest rates from doubling and, you know, asking wealthy Americans just to pay their, not even pay their fair share, but pay obligations that currently are expected, but because of tax loopholes, they're able to avoid, which is equally recruiting to their base. So you're absolutely right. There's been partisan games left and right being played on this issue, and all while students and families are at the dinner table trying to figure out how to just pay for college next year. So it's gotten to the point where it's pretty ridiculous, and, you know, our message is clear to Congress. There really is no A for effort on this student loan issue. They have to figure it out, and they have to do it soon. And so partisan charades aside, they need to actually come up with a bill that both sides can support.
Absolutely, and I have seen more and more these families aren't staying at the dinner table kind of griping. I mean, I think there is a growing anger nationally. Definitely here in Bloomington, we have nightly marches against the rising cost for students to go to higher education. It seems, and of course, mimicking the protest in Montreal with the threat of a meager rate hike, it seems like, for college compared to what we pay. What's the public, what have you seen in the public that has been shifting as this discussion is happening in D.C.?
Yeah, well, this issue is really tapped into, I think, beginning to tell the story of why this is a cross-generational issue. You know, for years, student debt, and still most people, I think, would still view student debt as a young person issue. But now we're starting to see some major consequences of student loan debt, from young people not being able to buy homes. And so the home builders and realtors are, you know, starting to get really concerned, which, you know, you could argue that they're a core Republican constituency. You are starting to see more adults, more parents taking out loan debt for their kids, and that impacts how much they can save for retirement or how much they can, you know, save for other just expenses. And then you're seeing grandparents even with substantial billions and billions of dollars of student loan debt obligations. And if you're on a fixed income, we've seen stories of grandma's Social Security check being garnished for student loans. So this is becoming a huge national problem, and hopefully soon it'll transition from students marching in the street to parents and grandparents marching in the street, because that's really where this is going. And I think Congress is starting to recognize that, but they've been pretty slow to the uptake. So, you know, their focus right now has been on student loan interest rates, which they should absolutely figure out. But realistically, it is one of many pieces in a big puzzle that they need to figure out, and they need to figure out pretty quickly in order to combat rising student loan debt. So they can't just finish this, which it seems like they're doing painstakingly. They need to finish this and do more. And so that's what we'll ask of them next. And, you know, but here in Indiana, you know, our students at the Indiana University have been quite active. The Department of Education came by as part of their college affordability tour, and several students spoke there telling their story about student loan debt. Students in Bloomington also set up tables one day for a day of action, asking students to, in order to visually show the ballooning interest rates of student loans, ask other students to blow up a balloon and write 6.8 on it to take a photo petition to their member of Congress. So, you know, that's just here in Indiana, and things have been happening all across the country, really asking our members of Congress to figure this out. Now, Senator Lugar, especially, has an elder statesman who has continually focused on collaboration and bipartisanship over his time in office. While he is wrapping up his last few months in Congress, now is a perfect opportunity to really, you know, give one more shot at bipartisanship and showing what compromise can do, and help students and families here in Indiana. And send that message to his successor that actually it's good to compromise, and that's how we get things done.
All right, Rich, I want to wrap up here. We talked about all the intricacies that go into student debt, but I actually want to talk about how student debt is just a tiny intricacy of the entire economy. Can you kind of expound on why this is so important to begin here to really rally the entire economy?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, just to focus here on Indiana, you know, we know, as we talked about, folks are graduating with more student loan debt than ever before here in the state, and that's having big problems. So just looking at the impact of borrowing on the economy, student loan debt recently surpassed credit card debt as the top form of consumer debt across the country at $1 trillion. Such significant debt has serious implications for the economy here in the state. The vast majority of students who borrow a loan borrow from the federal loan program. About 8 in 10 student loans made are backed by the federal government. So this student loan interest rate settling issue is quite important if the low rates are not extended for another year. And the average savings per borrower will be about $930 over the life of a loan, translating to about $270 million of debt that they otherwise would have to take out. And we see this as a way to help stabilize Indiana's economy. So unemployment in Indiana is higher than the national average. The job market is experiencing a skills gap between the number of people without jobs and the skills employers are looking for in their employees. So by 2020, 58% of the jobs in the state will require a certificate for a college degree, with only 36% of the population having one. So by 2020, we will need 58% or 58% of the jobs in the state will require some sort of college education. But currently only 36% of the population has one. So keeping interest rates low on student loans will send urgent signals to students, workers, and the underemployed to get the post-secondary training that they need to adapt to new economic reality in the state. And like you mentioned, student loan interest rates are just one piece of many that Congress and decision makers need to address. Starting here in the state, the capital needs to provide more money for higher education institutions so that they don't have to increase tuition. As we talked about, that's one of the major drivers of student loan debt right now and college costs. At the federal level, decision makers need to provide more funding for grant programs like the Pell Grant Program, which is the cornerstone need-based financial aid program now providing scholarship aid to about 9 million students to help offset the cost of borrowing. And students can borrow over $5,550 each year in that grant. But also looking at student loans, both keeping interest rates low and helping improve repayment options so that students don't have to take all of their monthly payments or monthly discretionary income and put it towards student loan debt. They can max out their discretionary income at maybe 15% of what they're paying for student loans. And maybe they'll pay more over the course of their lifetime of their loan if they do that, but at least they can better manage their monthly payments.
Rich, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Again, we're speaking with Rich Williams, higher education advocate with the Public Interest Research Group for Indiana. He's on the phone from Washington, D.C., and we've been speaking about the July 1st deadline of the increase of the student loan rate. This has been Interchange. I'm your host, Allison Bektesh.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.